next agenda point is post-implementation reviews, 10, 11, and 12, and I give the floor to Filippo.
Hey, good afternoon. My name is Filippo Poli. As you can see from the lack of a name tag, I just recently joined the ISB. So the objective of this session is to provide you with an overview of the purpose and the process in the post-implementation review, and then ask your input about the topics that you recommend us we should bring to the attention of the board to consider to be included in the request for information. So if you go to slide 4 of the presentation, this is the process in a nutshell. We are at the start of phase 1, and during this phase, the staff will be meeting different categories of constituents in order to ask their views about their experience with the standard and the areas of concern. And then we'll bring this input to the board. We expect to do it early Q1 next year. And then the board will decide the content of the request for information. At the end of the comment period for the request of information, the staff will bring an analysis of the inputs together with the other evidence we're collecting. For instance, we have an academic who's performing a literature review on the topics. And that, at that stage, it will be when the board will decide what is the direction of the project. They can decide to ask staff to perform more work. They can decide to open some standard setting projects. Or they can decide that the evidence shows that the standards are working as intended, and therefore there is nothing more to be done. And actually, if you looked at the experience with the past implementation reviews, we have had all these different outcomes occurring. So slide 5, we have summarized what the due process, the book says about the post-implementation review process. And that's an occasion to debate all the implementation issues, all the challenges that people are experiencing using the standards, and especially is to collect evidence about what has happened during this phase where the standard has been used. So it's not really about re-debating the conceptual points from the development of standards, but really to use the experience of people to see what has happened and where we should focus our efforts. And then I will leave it to Jen for a short overview of the three standards.
I'd like to give you some background information of the IFRS 10, 11, and 12. Since you are quite familiar with the standards as you apply them every day, I will only cover a few key concepts. The first one is IFRS 10, developed in the context of the global financial crisis. It established a single consolidation model based on the definition of control. And the new definition of control replaced the previous concepts in IFRS 27 and 6.12. And subsequently, the board introduced a consolidation exception requiring investment entity to measure their subsidiaries under their control at fair value with changes through profit loss. The second one, IFRS 11, replaced IAS 31, requiring parties to a joint arrangement to classify their interests according to rights and obligations instead of legal forms. And in addition, IFRS 11 eliminates the accounting option for joint ventures, which means equity methods should be applied for all joint ventures. And finally, IFRS 12, serving as a one-stop disclosure standard for interest in other entities, provides combined and enhanced disclosure requirements of subsidiary joint arrangements, including joint ventures and joint operations, associates, and unconsolidated structure entities. Some of the new disclosure introduced by IFRS 12 include subsidiary with significant NCI, significant joint ventures, significant associates, as well as nature and risks of the interest in unconsolidated structure entities. And slide number 7 is a timeline of the three standards. They were all issued in 2011, and the major amendment of the investment entity was issued in 2012. And the effective day of IFRS 10, 11, 12 is 1st January 2013, with 1 year delay in EU area. And this year, we started our post-implementation review process. And I will hand over back to Filippo for the question we would like to ask for this session.
Well, the questions are on slide 9, but I would say it's really an open question because we are really at early stages of this process. So the question is really, can you tell us what is your experience in using the standards? Can you tell us what are the areas where the challenges are for you? It is helpful if you can point us to specific details of the standard rather than more generic comments. And I would say it's also helpful for us to understand whether we have is more about one-off application or recurring application. So, but it's really, I would say, kind of an open question to get input from you. So I will leave the floor to the members of the group.
Okay, thank you, Filippo. Is it only challenges or are you also interested in maybe goodies, benefits, or positive experiences in your standards? Or both, yeah?
All input is welcome.
That's good. Who starts? Sandra.
The definition of joint operations, you include the phrase, all other facts and circumstances. That can be viewed to be very broad and require a completeness assessment of all information that you're considering when it probably is a little bit overkill.
Liana.
Thank you. We were struggling with the different notion of control among the standards. IFRS 10 defines controls in one way or provides some indicators to assess control in one way. IFRS 15 do define controls also in another way, and IFRS 16 defines control in another way. So imagine the situation where you are in a CV with a customer where you have the control because of assessment of IFRS 10, but you have not the control of the plant because according to IFRS 16, the plant was designed by the customer, for instance, or was a takeover. And it is complicated to go through. I think a good revision among the three, the definition of control among the standards will be good.
On practical application of disclosure on 12, we do have associates that also are public and they issue accounts later than us. There's obviously a huge discussion, should we disclose their preliminary unaudited numbers before they publish? It's a very complicated discussion.
I can imagine. Sandra again.
And one of the things that may be helpful is to clarify the recognition of the relationship between the joint operator and the other partners. I think there were discussions on the relationship between IFRS 16, IFRS 11, and the IFRS interpretation on IFRS 16 that had some discussion of primary responsibility, and that highlights the fact that it probably needs to be addressed within IFRS 11.
Can I go back a little second to the first observation you made about the application of other facts and circumstances? Is this something that you have had to apply in practice? There are cases where you have had to override the legal nature of the vehicle because of other facts and circumstances?
This is input I've gotten from others in our industry. So I think it's the fact that it just doesn't say other facts and circumstances. It says all other facts and circumstances. And that is viewed as being very broad and requiring a lot more analysis and documentation, where it could be something, you know, much simpler if you looked at material, other facts and circumstances or something. It's that the definition is very broad. Okay.
In terms of IFRS 10 control assessment, when it really requires judgment, when we differentiate between substantive rights and protective rights held by non-controlling shareholders, for example, as a controlling stakeholder, you may have some rights to appoint key personnel. For example, you can appoint CEO and COO, Chief Operating Officer and Chief Executive Officer, whereas non-controlling shareholders may have chief financial officer. So in these type of situations, you require quite a bit of judgment, and I sometimes struggle to convince our auditors that to come to a proper conclusion in terms of control assessment when there are a lot of gray areas in terms of judgment has to be applied for cases where you need to assess the control assessment. So that is something which I found challenging in IFRS 10 implementation.
Juliana?
Yes. Coming back to the other factor circumstances, as Sandra said, and in particular, I find a little bit disturbing the example three in the examples, because if you go through such an example with a partner, you start to build up a lot of legal structure without changing the substance of the situation. I don't know if it is, when you are going through this example, you see that it's something that is not working properly.
Sorry, follow-up question. Your point is that you think the example does not reflect exactly what is in the standard, or is more...
The example says, in fact, if you are not, if you have not a transparent legal entity in order to put everything and put a joint operation, when you are intending to do a joint operation, mm-hmm. what you need to do is to have a CV where you are acquiring 50-50 in order to resell to the other party. I don't know what is changing in this case. I'm doing a CV, I'm taking 50%, my partner is taking 50%, I'm consolidating 50-50 of what we are reselling to the third party customer, for instance, suppose it is the case. At the beginning, the intention of the CV is to sell to third party and to collaborate with the partner. So, why go through this a little bit labyrinth in order to obtain something that maybe it is worth it to analyze otherwise?
Okay, Sandra.
It would be useful if the standard addressed different or allowed you to address different transactions under different accounting policy elections, especially when you have a lack of guidance or inconsistencies between the standard, like you have between IFRS 10 and IAS 28. Mm-hmm.
I've been a member of discussion at the Interpretation Committee and the Board as well.
Yep. Any positives? Does it work?
Yes. One more. I think when you're doing the financial statements of subsidiaries that are involved in some of these operations, but maybe not at the consolidated level, that you should be able to take into consideration what the users of the financial statements want versus once you have proportional consolidation to have to reflect that in the subsidiaries' financial statements using that methodology. So.
Is there any comment about, especially from the people from the financial sector, and I apologize, I still don't know everybody in the room, about guidance on investment it is?
We use it. Because I'm representing financial mm-hmm. In our group, we use these exceptions, and actually it's quite helpful, so we support this idea.
That was a positive statement. No more comments?
Or maybe I can have some other questions.
That's
I
good.
Was thinking, because we've spoken about IFRS 10 and 11, IFRS 12. any specific comments about too much information, not enough information, not clear how it's written. It has improved your relation with the users. Now they're asking less questions because they have already information.
Liana?
We had not questions about this particular point for our users, our investors, but I wonder why we need to disclose so much information if the principle is that we are not controlling it. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit difficult to internalize the idea.
Another question, Filippo?
I didn't want to ask too many questions because in this stage we are really more in a listening mode. I don't want to ask and say, okay, what about this or that, because I don't want to put
okay.
things.
So then we have... No?
Okay.
Well, we saved half an hour of time. Should we go back to the goodwill? Or...
You think half an hour is enough? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we have informed the agenda consult team that they should come earlier, but they haven't arrived yet. So let's wait until they come and then we will continue.